Hey, you guys, it's your host, Julian. This week is our Cow and Chicken reunion episode with David Feiss, Mike Ryan, Dean Taylor, Robert Alvarez, Charlie Adler, and Fred Seibert. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that helped make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get on to my chat with the folks that help bring Cow and Chicken to our TV screens.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's my head podcast? I'm your host, Julian, and today I'm joined by Fred Seibert. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Julian. Good to be back.
Absolutely. Charlie Adler, welcome back.
Do I have to say something nice like Fred just did?
No, you don't have to say anything. We're saving you for last. Robert Alvarez, welcome back.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, man, I have too. Michael Ryan, welcome to the show for the first time.
Hello, hello. Thank you.
I might.
And the man without no show, there would no be Cow and Chicken without the great David Feiss. David, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here.
Oh, man, it's great to have every single one of you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is our Cow and Chicken reunion episode. So we're going to kick it off with David explaining or walking us back through memory lanes of pitching Cow and Chicken. So, David, do you remember that day of pitching Cow and Chicken to Cartoon Network?
I do. Well, it actually started by pitching a raw idea of Cow and Chicken. And it wasn't the storyboard. This was to Ellen Cockrell. And I met her at a coffee shop in Vacaville, California. And and she was taking pitches for the Cartoon Network. I think it was 52 shorts, if I'm not mistaken.
48. Definitely 48.
So, yeah, she was taking pitches from people all over the world. And she'd been in San Francisco, probably at Colossal Pictures or something like that. And I was contacted by Larry Huber. He said, "Hey, Dave, you know, you got any ideas? Like this gal's near you." So I made arrangements to meet her at a coffee shop in Vacaville. And I had this idea that it was about 3 weeks old, which was a children's story that I told my daughter. And then I had drawn it up and I pitched that to her. And she said, well, this is exactly the type of thing we're looking for. She says, go ahead and do a storyboard. She said it right then, you know, just do a storyboard based on these characters. So, wow, that's pretty easy. but then I got back the children's book was, I didn't feel like didn't have legs. So then I came up with the idea of the the entire opening that became the pilot. But there was a point that I thought it's missing something. And that's when the red guy occurred to me. I brought the red guy in. And so, yeah, so I did the board, did it pretty quickly, probably in 2 weeks. And then I did pitch it to Cartoon Network. I pitched to you, Fred, I believe.
I don't think I was there, actually. That must have been a day I was out.
You know what? I'm mistaking it with the time when we were going to Sirius. So I don't know who I would have pitched it to. It must have been to Ellen.
There wasn't a group of people because often the way we did the pitches, Mike Lazo was there from Cartoon Network. Larry was there. Buzz Potamkin was there. There was like usually a group.
Was it Klein? Jeff Klein? I mean, who else?
Linda Zeminski.
Linda Zeminski wasn't.
Linda wasn't there yet.
Yeah. She wasn't there yet. Yeah. This was early. Betty Cohen was in the room, you know. Anyway, yours might have been different since you were traveling in from out of town.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually don't remember that moment. That's interesting. I remember a lot of different things, but that particular moment I don't remember. But I remember doing the board and they were like, "Let's go. Let's do it." And I said I like to animate it myself, and they said, "Great. Go ahead and animate." So it was just awesome. It took 10 months to animate that storyboard. So I got Dean Taylor to do the layouts. He was doing it little by little. He was in Dublin at the time. He'd send four or five shots. I'd animate those four or five shots, and they were continually coming to me. And it took 10 months from start to finish for me to finish my part. And then in the ink and paint, the camera was all done in Philippines. And then when at that point, you know, when the pilot was done, they do testing. They did the competition they had where people voted online. I think it came in second to Johnny Bravo was first, I believe. And when we did the focus groups, I remember the first time was in Dallas, Texas. I flew to Dallas for the focus group. And that was Linda Zeminski's first day at Cartoon Network. And that's where I met Linda. and Cow and Chicken tested poorly. Except, in fact, it was horrible. So it's like this. And I thought, okay, it's all over. I had to, you know, in 1 year work on this and all this, and it's not going to happen. But she said, don't worry. This is, we tested tomorrow in Chicago and in New York, and fortunately, it tested well.
There was a lot of behind the scenes fighting on Cow and Chicken, actually. Okay. But if I could step back for a quick second, Julian, I didn't know I didn't know any of these people from anywhere. I didn't come from the business, much to everyone's chagrin. But I had greenlit a show from Donovan Cook called Two Stupid Dogs. And I had in my head, I was really trying to recreate the Hanna-Barbera that I fell in love with as a 7-year-old with the Huckleberry Hound show. The 3 7-minute, you know, cartoons where they had Huckleberry Hound, Pixie and Dixie, and Yogi Bear originally. And I thought that format would be great for Two Stupid Dogs. And I insisted that for the middle cartoon, we do two Stupid Dogs cartoons, that we used a classic character. And Donovan Cook insisted that it be Secret Squirrel. Yeah. And I remembered Secret Squirrel from, you know, when I was a kid. And Larry Huber is the guy who said, look, in order to get this done on time, on budget, we need one guy doing everything. And he said, that guy should be this guy, Dave Feiss. He's up north. I never met Dave, and all of a sudden storyboards started coming in on Screwball Squirrel, which between us chickens were way funnier than the boards on Two Stupid Dogs, mm-hmm. which I was really excited about the potential for Two Stupid Dogs, but the Secret Squirrel boards were really good. They had a great, you know, feel to them. So when Larry suggested that, you know, maybe Dave had an idea for a short, I was like, okay, I don't know who this guy is, but he's funny. Let's go. And so from my perspective, that's how he came in. But then because I wasn't in the room, my number two guy was a business guy from Turner named Jed Simmons. He was really my partner in, you know, getting things going and keeping the wheels on the bus, especially on the Turner side. And one day he comes in, he goes, hey, have you seen the storyboard from Cow and Chicken? And I was like, no, is there a problem? He goes, no, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. And he had been in on a lot of the other pitches. And he gave me the board. I was about to get on an airplane and I took it with me. And I'm looking through the board. And it is to this day the funniest raw board I've ever seen. Like of any show that's ever been pitched, it was hilarious because Dave really fit something that John Crisolussi had told me early on, which is every drawing by itself has to be funny. And sure enough, the drawings were funny even before you read it along. And as I told you on a text the other day, I was laughing out loud on the plane and everybody around me is like, what's going on? And they were all looking at the screens on their TVs, like on their seats, like, is there a funny show that we're missing? You know, and I didn't even have the TV on. I just was like turning the pages on the board. And it was, you know, fantastic, obviously.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Now, I want to circle back to what you just said. A couple things you just said, David. You said you find out you had something as soon as you have Charlie. Well, Charlie, I'm pointing this way now. The red guy. The red guy's he's coming into the show now. How soon into you coming up with the red guy, you're thinking of Charlie for the voice for not only the red guy, but as well as Cow and Chicken for that pilot episode?
You weren't.
I didn't know Charlie at the time. So when I came up with the red guy, I had no voice at all in my head for that. It was just like, you know, when I had finished finished the board and it was time to record, okay, we're going to record this thing. So before animation, you record the whole thing. We had to like have a casting call. So they put out a really wide net and everybody came in to read. There were a lot of people to read for each individual character, like Cow, Chicken, Red Guy, the mom and the dad, and Cerberus the dog, I think. And so this one guy comes in and he said, "Oh, I'm going to read for all of them." So, okay, great. And he was
no confidence there.
Yeah. He gets in there and seriously, the first thing he did, what he did the red guy, right? He said, "We recorded these auditions or these little trials or whatever they are. That's what I used in the pilot." It was just right off the very first thing he said. He just got right into the character instantly. He had that character. You know, "Hello, it's me, the devil. You know, I stand up for all that is bad." That whole thing, Charlie, that was your very, very first.
I don't remember one fucking minute of this. Not one. I really don't. I mean, I'm kind of going, "Well, this is interesting."
Yeah. So, and then you did cow, you did chicken. They're hilarious. And when I after the day was over, it was a full day, and there was, you know, I don't know, 50 people came in, maybe more. And Candy was there, and Dee was there, and I got back to my office, and I went through everything, and you were it for all three characters. It was like, he's the best chicken, he's the best cow, and he's definitely the best red guy. And then I remember Larry said, "Well, yeah, but one guy can't do all three characters." I said, "Well, about Mel Blanc?" And he goes, "Well, I guess that's true, isn't it?" So it was, there was a little bit of pushback, but not much. Everybody agreed. You were it. You nailed it. And you would do it in real time too. That's which was always remarkable to me. You wouldn't just do all cows and keep it that same voice. You'd have cow talking to chicken and chicken talking to the red guy, and they would talk to each other. And it was all in real time. It was like insane. Like, who can do this?
I kind of want to kiss myself right now. I don't remember the first parts of that. I don't remember the audition, really remember it. I just remember the sessions, and I remember that we would all go out and get drunk after.
Yes.
I was useless after recording three of those. That was it. But those were great fun, but I don't remember any of the preludes to this. I do remember my dear friend, my loving supporter, Gene McCurdy, always.
don't even.
Always lifting me up and never throwing any roadblocks in my way. But for the most part, it was such a joyful, wonderful time.
If we can jump to the end, or my end, I should say, sometime in 1990, early 1996, I got it in my head that we should do a short live action film of Charlie doing one episode and doing all the parts live, like on a camera with, you know, a spotlight down on him and everything else sort of, you know, black. And I had a director that I work with in New York who I knew would be really perfect for it. His name was John Kane. And we had it all set up. We had it all budgeted. And all of a sudden, the merger with Turner came through. Ted Turner had sold the company to Warner Brothers. It took a year for that to, you know, pass government muster and all that type of stuff. And Gene took over. And that fuckhead, the first thing she did was cancel the short.
Well, she canceled it because I had left Tiny Toons because I was disgusted with everybody.
Yeah.
Who walks and writes a letter to Steven Spielberg? Me. So she was in that seat at that time. And so it was just, you know, a vengeful act of a woman with no teeth and a double wide ass and a very big Sharpie.
It's the only regret I have after the 5 years I had at Hanna-Barbera. The only one. I was so ticked off.
Well, so was I. But you were so kind, and it was such an affirmation.
It would have been so great.
I'm not dead, you know.
We can make this happen. We can make this happen.
I can still do it, you know.
Yeah, David Zasloff will like sign off on it right away.
Good.
I'm that guy. Yeah.
Sure, have another drink. Yeah.
So getting it back to the pilot, man. So we've cast the character. No, you're perfectly fine. I that's why I love this medium, man. We can go wherever we want to go. There's no chains holding us. But for the pilot, so obviously you've got Charlie and you got Dee and you've got Handy. When does Mike and Robert come into it? Obviously, you do all of the animation by yourself. Was that a standard thing for a lot of the creators? Would they animate this themselves? Would they farm out the animation?
As far as I know, I was the only one that animated the short.
Yeah. There might have been a couple of others, Bruno Bazzetta.
What about Gendy on his first Dexter? Did he do
He did change. I know he did quite a few of them for the changes one. I don't know if he did the entire thing, though. But I'm pretty sure he did.
He might have done it on Dexter.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So there were, here and there, Robert and Zeddy might have done one of his, for Mina. But it was unusual. But, one of the things that I thought was really important in all of these shorts productions is that our job was to support the filmmakers in the way they wanted to do the film the best way possible, unless we thought it was like a complete train wreck for, whatever reason. And so different filmmakers had different needs. Different filmmakers had different strengths. Many of them had weaknesses. They had been a storyboard artist and they really didn't know how to put together a film. Others had been character designers who got together with someone and wrote up an idea. Michael and Butch Hartman did a cartoon together early on too. Mm-hmm. You did Gramps and Hillbilly.
The Hillbilly Crawdad or something.
Right. Like and so everybody did it according to their own strengths and weaknesses and needed support in a variety of ways.
Got you.
That Michael, is that so? Just a quick question, because I knew nothing about. I think I was in one of those.
Yeah, shows. Yeah. Of course you were.
I mean, I'm just really trying to reach
you. Were.
But David,
I'm pretty sure you played the crawdad. If I remember correctly.
I played some asshole.
This was 30 years ago, though. Jeez.
But David, is that how you became familiar with Michael? How did you guys connect on the show?
I was like following him home up to like Folsom. I was in Folsom prison and I did that escape where you have to swim. And then I ended up on his doorstep and he was like, I guess this guy needs
a job. You in a little basket or you're just standing there?
I was just standing there. Oh. Sorry, David, go ahead.
That's funny. Yeah. No, it was after it was greenlit the series. So like, okay, pilot's done. It's already been tested. It's already aired on Cartoon Network. It's decided, okay, we're going to do 13. Half hours. And Bill Burnett was brought in, I think, at some point.
Yeah,
and
Bill was up first, yeah.
And more than anything, I Am Weasel, I think, too. Like, he was pretty instrumental in that. But Mike came in as he was just recommended to him. Here's a writer. And we hit it off. I mean, I felt really super comfortable with Mike. We could talk about any stories. We came up with hundreds of stories, usually over beer, even at the breakfast places. There's no beer at the breakfast place, but we did a lot of stories at breakfast, but more of them were at Timmy Nolan's.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Well, you were commuting. So David would, he lived up in Sacramento in that area, and he would fly down for like 3 days. He would go back on Friday, right? You Friday and come back on Monday or something. So it was like,
yeah, it was Tuesday through Thursday.
So he was like, I got nothing to do. And he's like, let's go break stories. Cause you were really busy during the day. Yeah. And so then we would go to Timmy Nolan's, just the two of us, and drink pints of Guinness and, and make up stories, just insane ideas, whatever would come to mind. I was saving the story, but I'll just do it now because you mentioned Timmy Nolan's. It's my favorite story. Is that we had, as David said, we did like hundreds of these stories, and then they would get animated and they go out, and so we got an angry like hate mail from a mother in Montana who told us that the show was horrible. It's the work of the devil. It's disgusting. And those writers must be high on beer when they write those stories.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, how did she know? But I love the phrase high on beer.
That's specific beer.
Yeah, it was. That's what she said.
That's too great.
High on beer.
Oh my God. Yeah, you so must have been.
So when does Robert come into the fold, David? I know you said he started coming out when the series, or Mike came in when the series got greenlit.
And Robert also could, but Robert, you were at Cartoon Network, Hanna-Barbera before that. You were, you've been there for, I don't know how long at that point.
300-400 years.
At least.
So, yeah. so you were there like 10 years before I started it. You were saying you were 55. Did you start at Hanna-Barbera?
Well, no. Well, yeah, I started on Hanna-Barbera shows, but I was working for like people that were doing contract work for them, because the first show I worked on was the Banana Split Show in 1968.
Yeah.
And that was for Fred Calvert. And then I worked for some other guys, Tony Love and Bill Hutton, who were doing subcontract work for Hanna-Barbera. And pretty much during the 70s, that's what I was doing, working for the subcontractors and picking up work around town from the various subcontract workers. And then finally, Hanna changed, for whatever reason, decided he didn't want to job out work to these subcontractors. And he said, well, let's just put a lot of these guys on staff. So I actually went on staff in 1983 at Hanna-Barbera, but I still worked at home until I got a phone call from Bill Hanna asking me to help him on the Jetson feature. And then I was there when you did your pilot, but I had nothing to do with the pilot. But when you did your pilot, I was working on Dexter's, and I don't know how I got onto your show, except I do know that I was on Dexter's, and Guinea was telling me all the things I would have to do. And I'm looking at the list of all the things I had to do, and I'm looking at my pay, and I'm going, wait a minute, something's wrong with this picture. I'm doing all this shit. I'm not just directing. I'm doing a lot of stuff. And I went, I don't think so. And then the opportunity came up to work on your show. And I told Guinea, well, I'm going to leave Dexter's. I'm going to work on Cow and Chicken, which I thought would piss him off, but it really didn't. He was, genuinely nice about it. And I eventually worked with him on a lot of other shows afterwards. And so once you had the series, I don't know how I actually got onto your show, because I don't remember having a conversation with you about it at all. I'm sure we did, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, I remember I was like, asked, who do you want to direct? And I remember they had sent me examples of what everybody had done. And yours were always timed beautifully. It was like fantastic. And so to me, it was a no-brainer. Yeah, Robert. And so you were like number one. You were the first guy as one of these staff directors of the series.
And Alvarez, your timing is so fucking hilarious on Cow and Chicken. I mean, I've been watching, they did a marathon, howling, the silences, the beats, everything you did was so fucking funny. And
well,
you're amazing, amazing. Your timing is amazing.
I gotta say something honestly. I lucked out because I worked on it, and I worked on a really great show, Cow and Chicken, and everything about it was good. The boards were good, the writing was good, the voices were good. I mean, everything was really so good about it. I just showed up and did my job, and lucked out that I got to work on all four seasons. So I can't take credit for being some great director. So I was just very lucky that I was in the right place at the right time.
Well, if I could back up a little bit, one of my unsung heroes in this whole process was Pat Ventura. Mm. And it kind of goes like this. Early on, when I first announced these shorts, nobody showed up. I don't know whether they thought I was crazy. One of the guys told me he thought I was lying, like that I was like an executive that told people what they wanted to hear and I didn't really mean it. And that if anyone actually showed up, that I would tell them, no, I was just kidding, that type of thing. And one of the earliest people I went after was Pat. And it was a simple reason. I had no idea what I was doing. John Crisfalusi, for whatever issues John had been really influential in my thinking about all of this stuff. And he said, how come you haven't gone to Pat Ventura? He's a guy, he loves Tex Avery. He's like, okay, I'll go to Pat. I'll do whatever Pat wants, So this is really early. I don't even know that I had made an announcement yet. And, I was thinking like a producer. So I figured, okay, I have this much money. I can make twice as many cartoons if I make them 3 minutes and instead of, you know, 7 minutes. And I said to Pat, so there'll be 3 minutes. So he starts yelling at me. and he's like, you can't make them 3 minutes. What are you going to find out in 3 minutes? A bunch of gags. That doesn't make a cartoon. You can't get characters out of that. I said, what should they be, Pat? He goes, well, they should be like all the classic cartoons. They should be like, you know, 7 minutes. Okay, fine. There's 7 minutes. Instead of doing 100, we'll do 50. You know, it was literally like that. So he had an early cartoon. In fact, his first one was a Tex Avery. These two characters he loved, George and Junior, that had been a Tex Avery thing that didn't go too far. And he starts working on them. So first, Mario walks in my office and he goes, oh my God, you're actually doing it. I go, well, what do you mean? He said, you hired the craziest person in the studio to make a short. You were serious. You really want it? I'm like, oh, okay. You know, like whatever. Like I still didn't know what was going on. And the production has started and, you know, there was the whole classic cadre of production people who were eager to smash whatever it was we were doing. First of all, they were really pissed off that I let the Two Stupid Dogs guys produce the way they wanted to produce the show, right? Instead of going through Ray and the directing system and the producing system and Jane Barbera and like whatever. And so Pat comes in one day and he goes, you know, they're ruining my short. You said that I could do what I wanted to do. And I said, okay, what do you mean? He goes, they're making the eyes blink. And I'm like, yeah, is that a problem? He goes, eyes don't blink in great cartoons. Eyes only blink in Hanna-Barbera cartoons where nothing else happens. And they make the eyes blink so that it makes it seem like there's animation going on. Now, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. And so I guess I went to Buzz and to Larry, who were sort of the executives that were running production. And I go, what? And Larry said, oh, well, you know, we have to do it with Robert. And I went, what do you mean? He goes, well, he's the only one that'll do it the way it ought to be done and the way that Pat wants it done. And it's Pat's cartoon. He has to do it the way he wants to do it. Like, again, I still didn't know what was going on. And Robert came in and it was sort of really the beginning from my perspective of Robert and I sort of having a space together, you know, because he understood what Pat was saying and he said, okay, I can do it the real way instead of the Hanna-Barbera way. And that sort of started it out. So it wasn't an accident that Robert ended up on anything. It was people who knew what they wanted. They knew what they needed. They knew they needed a director who could understand the filmmaker that was making the film. And I don't know exactly how he got onto Cow and Chicken, but since I know what Dave did in the original pilot, I don't know that there was anybody else on the crew other than the Gendys and the Robs who really took directing seriously that could have been involved.
So there, Robert.
Yeah. Well, you know, I for years and years, I would always tell people on, and then this is going, you know, way past cartoon, you know, Hanna-Barbera into later years. When I would work on any show, I would always tell them this: I'll do whatever you want. Tell me what you want. Even if I didn't like it, I would just say, right, "What do you want? I'll do whatever it is." And believe me, I worked on a lot of shitty shows, but I was just doing the job and giving them what they wanted. But I was going to say, you know, I worked on all six of Pat's shorts, and that was a fun time because Pat would ask me sometimes, like, what do they normally do? And then he would say, okay, we're not going to do that. He would break every rule that he possibly could just so he could be different. And that's what made it fun.
You bet.
Beautiful, man. Well, thank you guys for sharing those stories. So before we rotate into the fans' questions, I figure what we can do, since Michael popped everybody's cherry first with his favorite Cow and Chicken story, who wants to go next as far as your favorite story or favorite memory or favorite piece of time on Cow and Chicken?
Oh, shit.
Well, Charlie sounds like he wants to go first. Charlie, what's your favorite time or favorite memory or favorite story from your time with Cowan Chicken?
All of it. One that keeps being repeated to me by Michael Dorn, any chance he gets, which still makes me laugh, is Michael came in. We were doing I Am Weasel, so I guess this is kind of a Cowan Chicken story. And I was Weasel, right? No, he was Weasel. I was Asshole. Baboon. And Michael was very formal. And he sat down the first day and, hi, how you doing? How you doing? And, oh, very nice to meet you. And his lines came up and he was going, I thought it was like fucking Shakespeare. So at one point, I had enough of it. And this is the way he tells it to me. So I'm not embellishing. This is his version. And I was getting, but from where my perspective was, oh, come on, lady.
Yeah.
Just dance with me. Fuck, just dance with me. Play. Nothing. And finally, as he tells it, I got so exasperated. I looked at him and I said, who the fuck are you, Olivia de Havilland? Just fucking play with me, man. And from that minute on, we became instant pals. I mean, we're still in each other's lives and I love him. But he brings this up. And so I call him Mr. Havilland. He calls me, I think, Joan Fontaine. Because they were sisters.
Well, they did hate each other.
They did. But we love each other. True. I mean, it was so that I think that's one of my favorite stories because the way I work is not particularly sane. I kind of free fall and just, I don't know what I'm doing half the time. But I trust that I'll do it. And when I'm working with somebody very formal, it's just, come on. And that's where I was with him. And then it all went away. And then we just danced and I love him. He was so great in that show.
I know a recording studio story when we were still at Hanna-Barbera doing Cow and Chicken. One day I went to one of the recordings, and this was early on, and I, even if I could remember her name, I won't say it here so that she can still go without having a target on her back.
What's it rhyme with, Robert?
What?
What's it rhyme with?
I can't remember her name. That's how forgettable she is. And
it'll come to me and I'll say it.
The first voice director on the show, before Chris or Colette or anybody, it was the first lady, and she was terrible. And I'm sitting in the booth this is at Hanna-Barbera. It was like that bench sofa, and Vincent Davis is sitting next to me, and she was so bad because she would do things like, come on, do better. And you know, you would just look at, and so Vincent reaches across the booth with his hand and grabs the back of her chair and pulls her away from the board slowly.
I thought that was great. I don't know who the fuck you're talking about.
It wasn't Chris.
Andrea Romano? She wasn't on.
No, later. It was not Andrea
Romano. She wasn't there. Yeah.
She was gone already. What a pity.
It was actually a friend of Sherry's. She brought her in.
What?
I remember.
Oh, Michael, please say it. Say it. Say it.
No, even if I do remember, I don't want to say her name, but I do.
God
remember.
Damn it. Text it to me. Yeah, who the fuck? I have no memory of this at all. At all.
Well, you wouldn't have seen what Vincent did because you were in the, you know, with the other act.
I didn't see what anybody did. I was so in whatever place I was to do that fucking show. A bomb could have gone off. Can I just tell a real quick Joe Barbera story?
I don't think it's Cowan Chicken, but it
makes me laugh to this minute. He was, you know, kind of old and still in his henna hair and the tie and very formal. And he came in to watch a session and I was blabbity blabbity blab. And he came in during a break and he said, and by the way, I had known him for years. He just forgot for many reasons. and he walked up to me and said, young man, which now I like hearing, young man, it is very important that you articulate and that you have very good diction. And I said, yes, Mr. Barbera. He said, tell me your name again. I said, "It's Charlie." He said, "Very nice to meet you, Stoddard." I thought, "You're talking about diction? Get the shit out of your ears." I'm officially Stoddard. I don't. Was that Kelly? I don't remember what it was. I think it could have been. I don't know. That's the only story I got
about Joe. Oh man, well, I appreciate it. Who wants to go next? Robert, Fred, David. Who wants to go next?
David, your show.
What was the question?
Yeah, what was the question?
Favorite memory from Cow and Chicken's production, or favorite time out and about with everybody.
God. Well, while he's thinking, I'll tell you that Vincent Davis story that I talked about. Vincent was always a fun guy to be around because he liked to go on adventures, especially lunch. He liked to go to places that we had not been before. So he's always doing something different. And he was not bashful or shy about his particular medical condition and what his final outcome was going to be. But at his memorial service, Fred Wolf told me this story. They were in Japan and they were going to see some clients, some Japanese animation clients. And Vincent shows up wearing camouflage shoes, camouflage shoelaces, camouflage socks, camouflage pants, camouflage shirt, camouflage jacket, camouflage glasses, and a camouflage hat. And Fred says to him, "Vincent, what the hell are you doing?" And Vincent's reply to him was, "I don't want them to see me." That was he was a lot of fun to be around. And I don't know if you guys remember him when, because he would do his he did a different dialysis. He didn't do hemodialysis. He did peritoneal dialysis. But he would do once a day in his office. So he'd have the big music stand out with the bag on top, and he'd hook it up to the tube in his stomach. And he didn't care if anybody walked in because the door was always open. I remember him doing this once where somebody, where I was sitting here talking to him, somebody walks in and he holds up the tube and he goes, "Want a hit?" He just didn't care. And he was always about having fun.
It was friggin' great.
He was a great guy. I miss him. And I have a lot of fond memories of Vincent.
Yeah, Vincent's
fun. Sorry to bring everybody down.
Oh, no. We're gonna stay on this track for just a little bit, because when everybody comes up, I did it with Charlie, with Christina Cavanaugh, because she was no longer here, and she's such a huge part. Anytime somebody that comes up that is no longer here that was so well-loved like Vince, so well-loved like Christina, we like to sit on this memory for just a little bit, man. So does anybody else have any fun Vince Davis stories?
I have another one if you want to hear it.
Absolutely.
Like I said before, he liked to go on adventures for lunches. One time, now we're at Sherman Oaks, and he decided, let's go have lunch at Felipe's, which is down by Union Station. That's a bit of a drive just to go for lunch. But another time, when we already had moved into Cartoon Network, I don't know how he found this place, but it was off of some street in Burbank, kind of in an alley right next to a auto repair store or shop of some sort. And it was a Mexican food place, but it really looked like it'd been there for the last 75 years. It didn't look clean. You sat at some benches and tables and it looked pretty messy. And I'm standing next to Vincent and I said, "Hey Vincent, do you think this place is okay? What do you think it's rated?" And he goes, "A C." I go, "Well, how do you know?" And he said, "Because the guy's standing on the card." That was Vincent.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that story, man. So Fred, we'll end the stories with David, but when you think of Cow and Chicken, does any story come up from the production or any chats you might have had with David or the rest of the crew?
Well, you know, at my best, I had nothing to do with anything related to production. I actually don't think I was ever at a voice session. I certainly wasn't at any story sessions. That's not what I do. Right. I don't know how to do any of that stuff. If I did, I would go, but it's not what I know how to do. What I know how to do is find people that are as stunningly talented, just as these gentlemen are, and give them their heads to do what they got to do. So unfortunately, all my stories are negative ones, like the not of the production, of the syndication people telling us that they couldn't possibly syndicate this because of the devil. And that, like, the South, you know, I'm from New York City, and I don't know anything about the devil being anything other than a character. Mm-hmm. And now they're telling me they can't sell this across the Bible Belt anywhere, and we got to get rid of, you know, the devil. And I'm like, what? I mean, I like everything related to this thing, the messages I would get, I was just confused on every level. And honestly, I think that might have even come up before we greenlit the series, because I know that Betty Cohen just fought like crazy not to do this show. She just kept saying she didn't want to do it. And she had all sorts of, maybe there was that focus group. But what it really came down to is she was really annoyed that Ted Turner said that we had to make our shows for Cartoon Network and that she wasn't allowed to go to other studios. And it had, again, it had nothing to do other than challenges that we had, because Betty and I had worked together at Nickelodeon. And she allegedly ran the department, but I had all the power in the department as a consultant. And it just bugged her that I got to decide what to do. And it bugged her even more when the series were all developed out of Hanna-Barbera instead of out of their place. I mean, it got so stupid that we had named this series What a Cartoon, and Cartoon Network insisted on calling it World Premiere Toons, because for whatever set of reasons they had for doing it. So we had two names. So it was all this kind of stuff. So my job was sort of like batting people away behind the scenes, you know, and accountants saying that the shows would never like earn their money back. You know, with Dexter's Laboratory, it took us like a year to convince them to make 6 episodes. Because they kept trying to pencil out like how much money it would make in 10 years. I'm like, how the fuck do you know how much money it's going to make in 10 years? Nobody knows anything about cable TV. Well, it's never going to earn. And like, it was so stupid. So those, unfortunately, are my stories. And all I can do is like enjoy what came in. You know, like my favorite poster that we did for What a Cartoon was the Cow and Chicken poster. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I love that. It's like one of my favorite things I've ever had anything to do with.
Fred, with all the conversations behind the scenes that were driving you crazy, is that why we changed calling the red guy Devil to the red guy? Was that part of that thinking?
Yeah, that's it was all part of, you know, the truth is, if there had been a standards and practices group, we probably wouldn't have done the show. Well, we certainly wouldn't have had the devil. Let's put it that way. Uh-huh. Right.
Well, we had the carpet munchers.
Yeah. Right.
I don't mention that.
That was my favorite.
I'm telling you, we had no standards and practices people. Like, nobody understood. I mean,
they pulled it that. Hard. It was.
We killed people in the Johnny Quest show. Let's leave out how that was the biggest disaster of my career. Almost wrecked my career forever. But we literally killed people, which, you know, you're not allowed to do in a kid show. But there was nobody to say no.
And look, look at this. We're all still here. Ain't that some show?
Oh, completely.
Look at that.
Completely.
The red guy.
You guys were on the right side of history.
Having a different name was fun, because I know David and I would have to try and come up with different names all the time for every single time. So it was like, what was one of my favorite was like Seymour Butts. It's like, we'd always like imitate Charlie in our worst Charlie voice. We're like, Butts, Seymour Butts. You know, so I mean, like, we would just like,
I don't know if any of you guys heard about this terrible documentary that just came out about Nickelodeon.
Yes, I saw it. And, I saw it.
And one of the complaints out of somebody is that they had named one of the characters something taint.
Yes,
I remember that. Yeah.
You know, it was like there was all this, you know, after the fact,
right?
Stuff.
The forensics of sin. Well, but that was a very different. That whole documentary was so shocking and horrifying and true. So I guess part of it was the taint thing, which, yes, well, I guess that was they slipped that in, pardon my French. And they did get away with it. But had that only been the only egregious thing, nobody would have given a shit about it. Right. Looking backwards, you know, I don't think anybody here was guilty of anything other than being, you know, just irreverent and ridiculous.
Well, we had no kids on the show, too.
That's right. And, you know, but I got to tell you, standards and practices.
Who could misinterpret information also. Because a lot of those complaints were children's interpretation of what was going on.
Yeah,
it was weird.
Dean.
Dean Saylor, Elizabeth and Dean.
Mr. Rip Van Winkle.
And Julian, unfortunately, I got to check out. I'm really sorry.
Okay. Oh, you're perfectly fine, Fred. I appreciate you.
You guys have heard everything except how honored I was to be able to be part of making this show happen. I really think it's one of the most special shows that I've been involved with in my career. And I've had a lot of great runs with a lot of great shows, but this one had a number of special elements, and these gentlemen that are here are the reason.
Hey, Fred, thank you. I just want to say thank you, because I know that you championed so much of this, and I never really got to thank you for what
you
shit on,
and I appreciate it. But that was tough.
Thank you, and it's so good to see you. And thanks for
absolutely all of
it
you.
Means
guys.
A lot, Fred, to hear that. Really means a whole lot. And I do remember that I would not have gone to Sirius if it wasn't for you, because there was a lot of pushback, and you were adamant about it. And it was because of you that we did it. And thank you.
Absolutely. Well, we're all on the same bus, so that was it was a great bus to be on.
Yeah, it was a special.
Thanks for having this reunion, Julian. Absolutely. Once again, you're one of the great heroes of the cartoons of the 90s and early 2000s, and you're memorializing it, you know, forever, in a way that, you know, I think all of us wish that the cartoons that happened before we were involved in the business were memorialized this way. It would have been great. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, you have a great
take care, everybody.
Fred, man. I appreciate it. Okay.
You too, Fred. Man. Thank you. Good seeing you, Robert. You look great. You look great.
Well, I thank you for that.
Take care.
Bye.
Right. Yeah,
see you, Dean.
All right, we're good back and we're joined.
Fred. Hi, Dean. Dean, I've never met back. You in person, but it's sure great to see you. I'm Charlie.
Good to see you too, Charlie. Yeah. It's been a very long time between series.
Well, how long? Just for shits and giggles, how long ago was this show? Did we do it?
29 years ago.
What?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Wait. Hold on.
We all had brown. 29. We had brown hair and eyelids. All of us.
It was 95, 94, 95, 96.
Oh, November 12th, 1995 is when that pilot hit. Yeah, almost 30 years. Yeah.
So we've known each other for 30 years.
30 years, because it was 1994. And it was October 94 that we recorded.
Oh, my God.
I think I still owe you $5, Charlie.
Say it again?
I think I still owe you $5.
Do you? Why? What did I do? What did I make you swear to?
It's been so long, but I can't remember.
Yeah. So, why keep it at $5?
With interest, that's got to be close to $100,000 by now.
Is that only $5? You got a cheap memory.
But it's in Australian dollars, so it's not worth a lot.
So Dean, we're at the point where we're talking about our favorite Cow and Chicken, or your guys' favorite Cow and Chicken memories from the production. Does one, before we get to David and rotate into the fans' questions, does one memory, one moment, or one interaction with any of these gentlemen here or anybody that's not on here stick out to you the most about Cow and Chicken?
I started to flip back through some old episodes and some a little bit of old artwork that I had, stuff like that, and looking for those moments. And to be honest, and in absolute truth, all the moments were great. There's not one that really sticks out, apart from the pilot. I mean, the pilot for me was just like working on pure gold. I've never worked on a show where I physically belly laugh as I'm drawing the layouts. I mean, you kind of smirk and you think, yeah, this scene is pretty funny inside your head. But I can remember drawing on the light box, which was a portable suitcase that I had, and just laughing out loud. And so for me, it's got to be the pilot.
Yeah.
Can I just say one thing? Because I totally just remembered this, and I'm sorry. I'll do it real fast. Having Phyllis Diller play my mother, Red's mother, was just insanely funny. Yeah. And just I think she was the funniest woman that ever lived. And we had become friends prior to that. But her doing it was like, what? Where am I? Just that bliss. Just that bliss of having that insane woman.
Beautiful. What about you, Dave? What memory or moment sticks out to you?
It's really difficult because everything encompassed the entire series. To me, was pure joy. You know, like talking with Mike, you were just mentioning about the names of the red guy. I mean, to me, that was one of the highlights. But working with you was certainly a highlight because we did spend a lot of time just coming up with stories. And I remember when I was told that we couldn't call the red guy, he couldn't be the devil. And I thought, well, he is the devil. That's the devil. And then it became actually better that his name wasn't the devil.
Totally.
It became so much better. I mean, like Ben Pants. Ivan Pants.
Yeah.
Ivan Pants. And you go,
ooh, Ivan Pants.
Literally.
Oh! Ooh! Oh!
And that, I think it's those moments, what you're doing right now, Charlie, those are the highlights. Doing the red guy and making every other actor lose their crap. You know what I mean? It was like, it was so much joy, the recording sessions. Because we were there for 4 hours, recorded.
We cried, we laughed and cried to the day. But and I loved every time you wrote something with the number nine. When I was nine.
I mean the writing part was awesome with Mike, but I think it was the recording. Mike, you were at all the recordings too. Yeah. The recording sessions were pure joy. It was just beautiful.
Do you know one thing happened with Dee was sitting next to me. It was at Salami Studios, and there was that curved wall, and I would always hold on to that wall for strength because I was just running out of steam. Yeah. And I would just sort of like go like this, catch my breath, and then go back. And I did this, and at one point I turned and I look at the page, and I'm starting to see that the lines are kind of going up and up. And I'm turning the page, and I think I'm having a fucking stroke. And everybody was acting. I didn't want to ruin it for anybody. And I turned to Dee and I said, Dee. And he looks up and I said, my fucking script. The lines are all curvy. I think I had a stroke. He said, no, no, they just printed that way. It was like so cash about it. Like, you know, old man, you're not dying. No, it's just that's just the way it printed.
Yeah. Well, I've got to add some color to both of those statements because, oh my God, the recordings were just genius. And that was, by and large, Charlie, 100%, because it was more than just acting. I mean, he would freaking embody these characters. And then there was a physicality to his acting when he was doing the character. You could just see the characters on his face, you know, and when he would do his body would change. His body would physically change when he was doing Cow, and it would be different when he was doing Chicken. And then when it would be very different when he was doing the red guy, I think he fully embodied the red guy. It was just so brilliant to watch him, and we would crack up. And then David would sit up next to the voice director. I guess Colette did a lot of that by the end. I think I can't remember.
Well, what a shame. But then we had Chrissy for a long time.
Was Chrissy maybe first? Yeah. Yeah. And then but you would have the boards out, and you were kind of directing, really, more than the director was directing. And he was acting out
the boards. I would watch David, and I would see David, like, the red guy would come up and go like this. David would go like this.
Yeah.
That's and he's sticking his ass out and kicking his leg up. I mean, you were always acting out the boards, David. I just remembered that, Michael. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, you were looking at me with the show. I was looking at that show.
Yeah. David, you know, he looks so quiet and mild-mannered, you know, he plays the guitar and everything.
He's a sociopath.
But he's been saying it, but like, he would act out every single thing. It was almost like he was animating in his head. And then if you'd watch him actually animate, like on the light board on the desk at work, he would do it too. He'd be like moving around, and then he would draw. Then he'd be moving around, and then he would draw. And then you come in, and it's like his hair is kind of down. He had longer hair. It'd be kind of like messy. And then he'd be all sweet. He'd be like, "Oh, hi," you know.
Yeah. Sociopath.
Yeah. And then having said that, a lot of the animators and storyboard artists and directors that I know from other shows, we all of us that know Dave refer to him as the Gary Cooper of the animation world, which is which is in complete contrast to what
that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think that's such a great description. Just level, grounded, easy, until you cut the fucker loose.
Until you let him loose, and then it's all hard band talk.
And can I tell you something for real, besides my own pleasure and my own joy of doing it and just getting invested and all that stuff? I was so gratified. I ended up in many ways performing, because I was a theater actor for a long time. Michael and David were my audience. And I used to, I was like a seal waiting for the fish, you know, after the scene, and I'd look up and they were howling. Yeah, yeah. You know, we would cut and then they were howling. I remember now as we're talking, that was so much of what I was doing too. The three of us used to make each other pee in and out of the studio. We would go out after, and I would always have to look at my driver's license to see who I was and where I lived. And so we would go, I would follow them to lunch, and we just sort of have to, you know, come down for an hour or two, and we'd get hammered, absolutely hammered after work.
Yeah, it was a blast. I remember laughing so much in all those lunches. We would the three of us would just go crazy. In fact, that's where we came up with the idea for No Problem.
No Problem for Sin.
The three of us were at this table drinking champagne. We would drink splits of champagne for some reason a lot. And it was just, they were a lot of, it was,
oh my God.
It was just brilliant. It was, those
were high times. It was a wonderful time.
Wow.
You know, I'd say something to the boys and girls out there in the audience that are going to be listening to this.
Uh-oh.
Charlie is the best damn voice actor in the business.
Oh,
without a doubt.
Yeah.
Thank you. I don't know how to receive that. Let me just go. Thank you.
Just take a compliment.
I'm trying.
It's the truth.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, like I said, boys, since we're wrapping up that, I figure we can rotate into fans' questions. However, Charlie, I had mentioned this to you on an email, so if you're up for it, I would love for you to do it. If not, we don't have to, but you did set the bar the first time you were on this episode, or excuse me, first time you were on this show, by doing the first song we ever did from a voice actor. So you did "Hey Mickey, You're So Fine," "Hey Mickey," as the red guy the first time you were on. Somebody wrote and asked that one. So I figured, since you played the devil, the red guy, I figured Motley Crue's "Shout at the Devil" would be a great way.
I don't know that fucking song.
I sent you the lyrics. It was just "shout, shout, shout" at the devil three times.
I'm a little busy. So wait. Could I just off the top of my head? Oh God, I don't know how that. So you, well, do it for me and I'll do it.
It was "shout, shout, yeah, shout at the devil," and you do it two times.
That's it.
Oh yeah, shout, the red guy.
Shout, shout at the devil. Shout, shout, shout at the devil. But I have this album in my head, I always have, Cow singing stuff. And I want to do just a quick little thing of Cow doing "Good Morning Baltimore" from Hairspray.
Absolutely.
It's so ridiculous. Okay, here goes, wait.
Woke up today feeling the way I always do. Oh, hungry for something that I can't
like that.
Good morning, Baltimore.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Oh, that was fantastic to any voice actor that comes on the show. That's the bar. Charlie's the bar. You have to follow that one from now on, ladies and gentlemen. So thank you, Charlie. I really appreciate it. So when I asked for these questions at that time, they only knew Robert, Dean, and Mike and David were coming on. They didn't know Charlie. But we did have some Charlie-centric questions, at least as far as the devil goes. So we'll get to those, and then we can go either individually, or we can just ask a couple, and you guys can all weigh in. So we talked a little bit about the red guy at the beginning. The RMJ Q&A wanted to know, he said he wanted to know as much as he can about the devil, so iconic. So since we're talking about icons and iconic characters, man, is there one moment in the red guy's time on the show that sticks out the most to you guys? Charlie, we'll start with you since it was your voice character.
Oh, I thought we were moving it off me.
No, not at all.
What was the episode with the Tanya Harding takeoff?
Skating Fools, was that the one?
Where he's in the red guy's with the blonde curly wig and the skates and all that. That made me laugh. And then he does a monologue about when I was nine, Mama would let me skate. No, it was pardon me. I just inhaled a small child. But there was one. Oh God, it came and it went. I'll think of it. Yes. This really doesn't have much to do with the red guy. It has to do with these two weirdos. Is I get a script and we never rehearsed. We just went right to recording. And I got mine, I'm looking at it, and I scan down, and I see ass wipe, ass wipe, ass wipe. And I say, guys, the fuck are you doing? I mean, I can't, the ass wipe tribe. And David looks at me with a straight face and says, "It's us we pay." Mm-hmm. What? No, it's us we pay. So that's what we did, was the us we pay tribe.
And David did have a straight face. Like, he really was. I almost believed him. I was like, "Hey, is that a thing?" It's like because he speaks Spanish and everything. I was like, is that like a Spanish word or something? You know.
Well, listen, you pulled a lot of shit too. I mean, now you were kind of right there, going, "Mm-hmm," like, "Yeah, idiot, you know that word?" Asshole.
I had to follow my fearless leader. You know.
What about you, Dean? Does any moment for the devil stick out to you?
I guess my favorite line is when he first introduces Cerberus, his dog, and turns to the camera and leans right up the camera and goes, "He has four heads." it's a real assumption that you should have made if he didn't pick it up already.
Yeah, you know,
this is my dog Cerberus. This goofy looking animal, and it's very just one to one. He has four heads.
Was the red guy proud of that? Was he bragging?
No, yeah. He was. It was almost like an aside. You know, like
Look what he's doing. See?
That's exactly what he's doing.
Gotcha.
Hey, Dean, before you came on, I was pointing out that you did these layouts for the Cow and Chicken pilot. I think you were in Dublin at the time.
Yes.
So you would send them in batches, like, you know, because you had a full-time job. And then at night you would do, you know, like a couple of sequences. And I remember the red guy sequence had, you know, the devil sequence was its own sequence. And I remember when it arrived and it was like Christmas, I'd get this package, FedEx, and I'd rip it open. And your layouts were in there. It was always, you know, he set the style of Cow and Chicken in that pilot that you know, lasted throughout the entire series, and I Am Weasel too, by the way. And his drawings are so visceral that remember, like, the background people couldn't quite, you know, grasp what he was doing. So what you see on the Cow and Chicken backgrounds are actually his pencil drawings Xeroxed on a cell. Just so it's just his pure energy on these drawings. But it was like Christmas when I would get your layouts, And it was specifically because I animated that. And so when that red guy, the devil scene came, I remember that moment very clearly. And I remember animating and doing that shot. And it was just like pure joy. It was so fun.
And that's sort of right across the board. A little bit of background about the Dublin connection. I was working on a feature film. Normally I'm based in Sydney, but I was in Dublin doing this feature film from my hotel room. I would do Cow and Chicken layouts at night, just as Dave said. But I partly because of the speed of it, but mostly because of the energy and the character of the show, I felt it was important not to clean anything up. I would draw the setup, design the background, stage the characters. I used to really enjoy putting in the poses because that's where I had my most fun. But I decided not to clean anything up and try and retain that energy. And I kind of assumed that I would at some point hook up with the background painters and explain the process. But when I saw Dave had made the decision to Xerox the artwork, part of me was a little bit nervous thinking, trying to remember whether I'd made them clear enough, or more importantly, what notes had I written on? Because everything got Xeroxed. The notes, the fielding, the instructions, any little comments, everything went on the layout. But it turned out that it matched the energy and the pace of the show pretty perfectly, and I think was responsible for its unique kind of look. But I got to add, we were staying in an all-suite hotel through the film, and the house cleaners would look at what I was doing on my desk, because I had my desk set up. It was a fold-out briefcase light box that I had made, and I took the desk lamp and took the lid off, the shade off it, and had the light inside it acting as my light box.
Oh, my God.
And so I was literally drawing on a real makeshift operation, and the girls at the hotel thought this was fascinating. And, of course, since it would do no harm, I explained to them what I was doing, and they fell in love with it. They'd come up and say, what's happening now? What's going on with the chicken now? So I'd run them through the sequence, and they'd be having a belly laugh at it. They used to sort of fight about who would come up to my apartment to do the cleaning so they could get the next bit of the show. It was very funny. So cool.
You know, the UK was crazy for Cow and Chicken and I Am Weasel, way more than here in the States. I mean, I went there to do a publicity junket, and I couldn't believe the reception and the people who came to events and who expressed what they felt. And there was something about the sensibility, the sense of humor, the irreverence that just captivated the UK audience way more than the US. And I mean, we had a lot of enthusiasm out here. I don't mean to undersell that, but there was something about the UK. They were just shitting themselves for it.
It was great. I remember also in Sydney, we were out one night at a pizza place, and my wife excused herself from the table. She wanted to go to the bathroom. And while she was gone, we had the beautiful big white tablecloths. So I thought I'll just draw while I'm waiting. And I had a brush pen, and I drew Cow and Chicken. I don't know why, it just kind of occurred to me. I hadn't drawn them for such a long time. And the waitress came up, who was Spanish, working in a Sydney restaurant, and her eyes went the size of golf balls, and she went, "Al rescate!"
Oh, my God.
And she said, "Cow and Chicken." And she gave me a hug, and then she said, stay here. And she went and got all the other staff, all the other waiters and the guys from the kitchen, and they formed a circle around the table looking at the drawing of Cow and Chicken.
Holy shit.
It was amazing.
Wow.
That's so cool. Did you guys ever imagine that that show would resonate with the Latin American folks as much as it did? Because there was quite a few people that wrote in from Spanish-speaking countries that said, thank you for giving Cal that accent, or Super Cal being able to speak in Spanish. You know, it really felt like that character was talking to me. I had somebody that talked to me in my own language. Did you guys know that you would have that big of an impact?
No, because I didn't know how to fucking speak Spanish.
Oh, I know.
And I was such a more I was such a moron. David would have to say phonetically each and every word, and I had to put them together, and then, you know, be convincing doing it. He told me what it meant, and blah, blah, but I didn't know crap from Christmas, and so I mean, it was kind of thrilling for me to be able to do that and feel like I didn't butcher it. So that's even more thrilling to know that nobody found me out. They thought that maybe it was really coming out of, you know, whatever. I didn't know anything. I was a moron, total moron about it. Inept.
What about you, David? Did you know?
No. I actually suspected that there would have been... They would have flopped it. And she was, when she was Super Cow, she would speak English. I didn't know. But I guess for the most part, they would just have the English version and they'd hear Charlie and they would have subtitles. And then when she spoke Spanish, they thought they must have.
Well, that's David, it's because I was so good at it.
You were so good at it.
I mean, everyone knew that I was really Spanish speaking.
Oh, I could tell.
Clearly.
You could roll them R's really well.
Kinda, maybe.
All right, so this next one's kind of for David, but you guys can weigh in as well, because I have to imagine. I know Robert for sure. We've had talks. You've had the chance to mentor a lot of folks that have come up in this industry, as well as you, Dean. I'm sure Mike, you've done it too, and I know Charlie, you've done it on your side as well. So, if there's anything you can give advice for, you guys can chime in as well. So, David, I consider you one of the funniest cartoonists on the planet, also one of my biggest influences. I know you have mentored quite a few artists, people like Adams and Perns, who went on to make some really funny stuff themselves. So I'm wondering, what are some of the key principles of theories you taught them on how you make a storyboard cartoon funny? And he said, also a shout out to Dean. We bumped into each other at Dave Enterprises a few years back, and we both worked on Grabba's Netflix show together. It's super inspiring as a fellow Aussie that he and Feloy, so I hope I pronounced his name right, worked on the show. Also, why is there no production art online anywhere? So, David, that first part's for you. What were some of those theories that you would teach about storyboarding?
By the way, that name, you mentioned Arthur Feloy. That's an old friend of mine. I was one of my first friends that I met at Hanna-Barbera back in 1978. And I know he's Uruguayan, but I guess his family immigrated to Australia. And I know, Dean, you knew Arthur.
Yeah, he was at Hanna-Barbera in Sydney.
Yeah, like one of the best animators. I think he was 17, right, when he started. He was like, I'd never seen such a good animator. He was a
freak.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a good way.
In a good way, yeah. So the question then is about what's the most important thing about, like, storyboarding?
No, so he was wondering, what are some of the key principles or theories you taught some of the people that came to you as a mentor for storyboarding?
Yeah, which for storyboarding and for animation, because to me they're the same. Like I think the same way when I'm boarding as if I was animating. And it was what Fred had said earlier about make every drawing as funny and clear as possible. If you're trying to be really, really funny, you got to make it look really funny in storyboard. And it's the same thing as when I'm animating. Every drawing that I would do, I was thinking that even though it's movement and it's moving, even every drawing should be able to stand alone. So I am thinking of that at all times. It's always on my mind.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And then what about you, Robert? Is there anything that you've taught to people?
Well, I would tell them a couple of things. Like, first off, don't quit. I mean, don't give up. You got to keep trying and trying until you get your foot in the door. I would also tell them, you don't always work on shows that you like, because if you only work on shows that you like, you're going to be very poor. And don't piss anybody off for the first 20 years, because you're going to be working for these same people over and over and over again. So, you know, try to be nice to everybody. And then when you get older, then you can you know, then you can piss them off. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, I would get students coming in, basically interns to my office. They would always trot them into my office all the time to meet, because like I was the old, when I was still at Cartoon Network, I was the old fossil. So they would bring them around to show them the dinosaur. And I would just tell them, you know, I never said anything like negative to them, because I learned a long time ago, when someone criticizes you negatively and in a mean way, you don't learn from that. What you learn is you don't like that person. If they tell you some criticism that's constructive, something you can use, it's fine. But I've been insulted in my younger career, and I just took it because I wanted to say, go fuck yourself. But I knew if I did, I'd probably get fired.
Yeah.
And that would happen. I don't think it happens nowadays, but I can think of several times when I was insulted by older guys at the time. I was maybe in my late 20s or early 30s. And the only thing I learned from that was I don't like that person, and I still don't.
Beautiful. Words to live by, ladies and gentlemen. Michael, what about you? Is there any advice you can give to some people on your side of the business?
Character first, always character. Character, character, character. It's like, and I think this is what was so brilliant working with Dave, was that all we cared about, we didn't like plot out stories. They weren't like story plots. You know, it was like the characters are doing this and then they get into this. And it was like, we almost let the characters build the plot because of what they wanted, and sort of like let them drive the story. And then a Vincent story for Robert is that when I started, I was kind of young and stupid and still stupid. I would overcomplicate things, which also goes to this thing. Don't overcomplicate it. It doesn't need to be overcomplicated, especially when you're doing 7 minutes or even 11. And he said, it's an old adage of Kiss, keep it simple, stupid. And so, but he would always try and like give me a kiss when he said it. So it was always like kind of a running gag where he would try and give you like, come on, give me a kiss. So to make me remember. It was keep it simple. Simple is brilliant. Let the characters drive the story and don't overcomplicate it.
So what about you? What about you, Dean?
All of the above is completely true. But it's kind of interesting when you're in the staging end, when you're doing the translation between storyboard and layout, you're kind of led to believe, or often you're conceived as being one of the background people. I mean, background in terms of performance, you know, character acting. There's many things that are generally thought to be left up to someone else. I take the opposite approach. I take every drawing as an opportunity to strengthen the backstory or the reason a character is doing something. Like when Chicken is sitting in front of the television zoning out, and Cow slides in beside him and starts playing with these little, or we call them the little thingy under the chin, but I believe they're called a waddle. So I kind of try, and when I'm doing the drawing, it's always in Dave's drawing anyway, but I try and find the next level underneath that. So what prompted Cal to do that, and how vacant is the look on Chicken? How, you know, what are they thinking? How deeply are they breathing? And that goes into the pose. And quite often that means deliberately leaving the working sketch underneath the cleaner sketch, so that the animator's eye can find the most pleasing line to follow. And it's kind of an interesting thing that I learned a long time ago. People's perception of the drawing is completely based on what they see in front of them. If it's too clean, too polished, too correct, that's what you end up with. But if you leave spirit and energy and the sense of humor, which is absolutely the most important thing with Cow and Chicken, leaving that sense of humor in there is a critical element. And that applies also to the background. Mm-hmm. The way the window shapes and allows the light to fall through is part of it. The choice of props, the furniture design, the choice of floor covering, everything plays a part. And it doesn't matter what it is or whether it features, it's always in there. And I just to end that, what I usually do is work to a rule of three. On any cut, if you can remember three things that frame the room or frame the shot, that's enough. Any more than that is overkill. That takes us into the keep it simple, stupid world.
Beautiful. Beautiful. What about you, Charlie, on your side? Is there any bit of advice you can give to any of the voice actors out there? Or actors, excuse me.
Keep it simple, stupid. is don't overthink. I think thinking is the enemy of acting. Mm-hmm. And I think that the minute you start watching yourself, thinking about what you're doing, analyzing how you sound, you're killing, you're dead. You're absolutely dead. And the only thing that's so thrilling about acting is the immediacy of it, is that there's no time for examination. And if you're in monologue, you've got to have your imagination is always at work. And if you're working off of other actors, you have to completely stay open, because whatever idea you think a scene is doesn't exist until the scene is happening. And as it's happening, that's what you're reacting to. And so energy feeds on itself. And the other thing that really struck me about what everybody said about the criticism and the critiques, I teach and I love teaching. And one of the first things I ask every single actor I work with is, what is the worst critique you've ever received? And what I've learned is that actors carry whatever was the worst, and they pick it. So I don't go, who said what to you? It could be your mother, it could be your cousin, it could be a director, a fellow actor, a stage manager, an audience member. But whatever it is that you reflect out as, this was the worst critique of mine, that is what you carry into a room always, until you get to burn with some rewiring as an artist, that when you burn those tapes that you carry, that's when you're free to act. But until you can identify what was the worst critique, and I'll give you an example. Somebody in a recent class said, well, somebody once said to me, I hate the sound of your voice. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you a real simple thing. They get much deeper and more complex than that. But if that's what you carry when you go into a room, you're always listening to yourself. There's no freedom. There's no joy. There's no immediacy. You're always playing to that one fucking idiot.
Yeah.
That makes a statement that's so destructive. And Robert, it has to be constructive. It has to be something that speaks to the humanity of whoever is opposite you, in any venue, in life. But an ugly critique is very painful and lasts. It does last. And that's, I don't remember the fucking question. I'm just yakking.
Oh,
I think I answered it.
Can I just add one thing to what he just said?
Absolutely.
Outlive your enemies and piss on their graves.
There's not enough urine in the world.
All right. So this is the last.
This is the t-shirt.
this is the last question, and then we'll do a little bit of a wrap up and then get out of here.
So Charlie, I gotta go take a shit before the hogs eat me, so go ahead.
Well, Charlie, we're gonna start with you, man. So if you could sum up your experience on Cow and Chicken with just one word, what one word would you use to surmise your entire experience?
Bliss.
Beautiful. Dean, what about you?
Joy.
Mike, what about you?
Shoot, I was going to say joy.
Joy squared.
Lord, you're a writer.
Blissful joy.
Blissful joy.
That was a stripper I knew.
that was my
point. What was his name, yeah. Charlie?
A man to reckon with.
R- Robert, what about you? One word.
Wait. Did Michael answer?
No, I can't think of one. I was going to say joy.
Oh, God damn it.
I chickened out. Mine is fantastic.
Fantastic. David, well, hold on. Mike, you've had some time to sit here and meander. You got a word yet?
Oh, my face hurts from smiling, so I'm going to say laughter.
Beautiful. David, what about you?
The word that comes to me is friendship. And I just feel like I'm, like, these are like true friends of my entire life, and I feel closer. What can I say? Friendship.
30 years, y'all.
Yeah, I often tell people when they ask me, like, you know, favorite shows you worked on, I always say, like, one of my favorite shows that I ever worked on was Cow and Chicken. Yeah. And I will tell you this, Dave, unfortunately, you know, and you know how the business works, you know, a show ends and everybody goes in different directions. And, you know, sometimes you don't ever see them again. So here's my opportunity, seeing you face to face, because I want to thank you for letting me work on your show, because it was one of the best shows I've ever worked on. And I'm so grateful that you allowed me to just be a small part of it.
Means a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
I reflect the exact same sentiment.
And same here.
I was going to say the opposite thing. Thanks for fucking up my life, Dave.
Well,
in a joyful way.
In a joyful way.
In a blissfully joy way. Anyways, ladies and gentlemen, this has been our Cow and Chicken reunion episode. So before we sign off, Charlie, I want to thank you for always being a voice that I looked forward to hearing every time I turned on a cartoon when I grew up. You gave me something to look forward to with every performance you did. Dean, getting to talk to you over these last couple years through email and then coming on my podcast, you know, we talked a lot about A Nightmare Before Christmas, right? That was a movie that I watched a couple times when I was a kid, but it wasn't until last year with my youngest son. I literally watched this movie 3 times a day, no bullshit, for about 6 months straight. This gave me an appreciation for the stories that you told me and the artwork that you pushed. Your artwork is second to none. Mike, this is the first time we're meeting. Thank you for giving me a script. Every time you gave Charlie a line to laugh at, I laughed my ass off, right? So thank you for that. Robert, we've had so many talks over these last couple years. You're one of my earliest guests, and you've been consistently a person that I can reach out to. And I'm gonna get multiple things. I'm gonna get laughter. I'm going to get a clear-cut, honest answer, and I'm going to get your brutal opinion on almost anything and everything. And I appreciate your clear-cut and just very straightforward attitude, and I appreciate everything you've done for animation your entire career. David, without you, I'm wearing this t-shirt right now, man. I've got Chicken right here. I've got a lot of those characters back here. Charlie, you voiced a couple of those characters, and I guarantee you all six of you men have worked on this show with countless others. So David, thank you for giving me a childhood worth having, right? I really appreciate every single one of you guys here. And if I could sum up Cow and Chicken in one word, or you guys to me, it's fucking beautiful. That's the word I'm going to take from one word. Cow and Chicken. Beauty. How about that one, Charlie? I didn't do too good in English, man. So, well, hold on. Michael got two words. He used blissful and joy. I figured I could just piggyback.
I tuned him out after blissful.
Well, you'll be an honorary member, you know what I mean? Of the Azuke tribe.
Well, so you can Julian threw in that French word.
What's that?
What French word was that?
Fucking.
Oh, I thought it was twat. Okay, that's British. Twat.
Well, this has been the Cow and Chicken reunion episode. That's been Charlie. That's been Dean. That's been Michael. That's been Robert. That's been David. And this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.